and Salida. Again, that was Black, and I've got a new underwriter tonight. It's support for KHIN and TruthQuest is provided by Tenderfoot Tavern, located at 109 North F Street, Salida, with nightly events. Friday and Saturday is karaoke, Sunday cribbage, Monday pool tournaments, Tuesdays three ball, and Thursdays open mic. For more information, 539-4030. And support for KHIN and TruthQuest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property, Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And I've got Alan Watt on the line here. And Alan is a longtime researcher into the causative forces behind major changes in historical development. He's a Renaissance man with a background in three professions, plus having various books published in religions, philosophy under pseudonyms. For much of his life, for his main income, he was heavily involved in the music industry as a singer, songwriter, performer, involved in folk music, pop, blues, pop, rock, and even classical. Also known for his session played with some of the most well-known artists and groups. Born in Scotland, he watched the subtleties of politics and media as they guided the population of the UK covertly into amalgamation. He has been warning the North American people for several years now that the same process of amalgamation has carried out. The reason why I keep pausing here at my printer didn't seem to print to the end of the sentence here. And so with historical documentation, he shows how cultures are created and altered by those in control, always to lead into the next pasture. Learn the true esoteric meanings of the mystery religions from one who knows. In his latest book trilogy, Cutting Through, Volumes 1, 2, and 3, again, I lost a whole bunch of it off here, so I'm going to let you finish that off, Alan. Are you there?
Yeah, they can go into cuttingthroughthematrix.com website, and I have books there for sale, and it's quite easy to punch up and see what's there. I also have discs as well. They go into these ancient religions and so on.
Yeah. Okay, great. You also have a radio program on another network nightly, or at
yes.
least 5 days a week, and that's Republic Broadcasting?
Yes.
And?
Yeah, it's Monday to Friday, and it's 8 p.m. Central. Eastern, yeah.
And that's an hour program each Monday through Friday. And it's a really great program. I've been following it for a year. You've been on doing that about a couple of years now, is that right?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and jump right in here and get into the meat of some of the things that are going on out there around us right now. And we talked a little bit earlier about maybe talking some on this G20.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to kind of get into what this is all about and what it means?
Yeah, it's quite. I mean, I think people who've been studying this for a long time, this whole global system, and the amalgamations of continents, in fact, such as the European Union. And we know, of course, they're already working, and they've been working for some years on the amalgamation for the Americas. It goes as far back as Karl Marx, who talked about this happening, beginning with the EU, then the Americas. Then he said that eventually there'd be a far eastern Pacific Rim conglomerate as well, under a global government. And the reason that Karl Marx knew that is because he belonged to the very same socialist-type forces, political forces, that were going to make sure this happened. And, of course, we always think of socialism as something to do with democracy and working-class say in what's happening and all the rest of it. But most folk don't realize that socialism has always been guided and funded by an intellectual elite with the bankers behind them, because it's the easiest way for the big bankers, who already run the books on economics, and we're all economic units according to them. They combine that with history and economics. They must ensure that all loans are paid by future generations, so they actually go into the data to do with projected a population to pay off debts and all this kind of stuff. So as far back as Karl Marx, the bankers already were involved in gathering massive economic data and population trends, etc.
What time
this
period?
This is what really socialism is. It's a designed, planned society where we'll be taught through science, scientific indoctrination, based again on Darwinism, where we are an animal and we can be retrained to behave in a certain way to conform along certain lines, and they can constantly basically upgrade us, just like a computer, with new political correct ideas, etc., until we're in some happy, strange utopia where there'll be no crime and there'll be an ideal population size worldwide. All of that is part of what we call international socialism. And we find those in at the top of all the European countries and the U.S. right now, and are basically socialists. And so are many of those who pretend to be in the right wing as well.
Alan,
so we're literally a one-party global system that's got masses of think tanks advising them on what to do. There's thousands of think tanks aligned with governments, and the think tanks, again, all get their funding from the same handful of foundations such as the Rockefeller Foundation. We're being guided along a path, and the G20 meeting was just a formality, a public formality, a pantomime, really, where they got together, had a lot of royal show, basically, and signed documents that had been years in the making by bureaucrats and liaison officers. They put the stamp on it. So it's a milestone they've passed into creating the IMF up to its proper status as with the World Bank to bring in the new world currency. It's just we're going through a script, a long-planned script, and the public are presented as though it's all happening due to present crisis. Nothing is further from the truth.
Alan, what time period did Karl Marx write?
Yeah, he did most of his writing supposedly around the 1840s. And
so he was,
and later on, of course, he even was best friends with Charles Darwin.
Okay.
In fact, he said that Charles Darwin's theory of survival, basically of the fittest, natural selection, special breeding, that type of thing, inferior types of humans, superior types of humans, validated Marxism. It actually validated Marxism because Marxism is based on the right of the intellectual class to rule the lessers.
Now, did the environmental movement kind of get discussed in that time period, too?
What we find is, at that time, people like Darwin and many, many others were into, it's a sudden hobby, a craze amongst the idle rich, you might say, to study all kinds of plants and animals, insects, and all this kind of stuff. And they did have a great interest in what they call nature. Part of it mainly is to do with understanding nature, meaning science. If they could understand how everything works, they could redesign all life, in fact. That was really part of it. But you'll find with those at the top, they're using a nature conservation as a scare tactic for the public. The threat of climate change caused by human beings is a fallacy. It's been well discredited by many scientists. But it's a must-be, I call it a must-be, from those at the top. They have think tanks that do nothing more, and actually foundations that do nothing more than build consensus amongst thousands of non-governmental organizations on the same topics. That's their purpose, get them all on the same topics, all on board, and they have a concerted front against all the public through the media. Until we get brainwashed with the idea that there's too many people on the planet, we're the problem. And the Club of Rome, that is one of the big think tanks, are the ones who came up with the idea of climate change and that man's the enemy, we've got to reduce the population. Again, it really fits in with this socialist economic ideal utopia with a reduced population, a manageable population for a post-industrial era. And under socialism, you'll find from some of their big speakers in the past. Now, they're into eugenics in a mighty way. They still are. They said that eventually people will have to come to them when they're in charge, and you will have to validate your reason for living. If you are not producing and consuming for their system, why should they let you live?
Is that called
I've got some tapes of them talking about this. Yeah.
Is it called like economy of scale when they're
talking? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so they've been quite adamant about this, and that is a socialist system that everyone has to, you're here to work, and you're here to work for their system under the guise of working for the whole of society. You're actually working for their system. It's no different, really, it's got a new dressing, but it's the Soviet system updated for the world.
Yeah. On population control, hasn't that been something that's been discussed numerous times throughout history?
Oh, yeah. In fact, in ancient Greece, they used techniques of war. They'd actually arrange wars between neighboring islands, because islands could only sustain a certain population. And every so often they'd have little wars, and they'd kill off a certain percentage and make a profit at the same time. And they wrote about it as well as a method of keeping the population down. But those islands were pretty small and pretty sparse as well, as far as vegetation went as well. So there's a different kettle of fish. But down through the ages, the ideas of Plato, especially in about the 2nd century AD and the 3rd century AD, were transferred to a new school of philosophy called Neoplatonism that was based at Alexandria in Egypt. And from there, they combined what they knew of sciences of their time and nature and started off political organizations, the precursors of what we now call international socialism. And many of the present leaders of this world movement for globalization, including Prime Minister Brown of Britain, who is a Fabian socialist, believes in Plato and the Platonic ideas. It has a form of a fascist covering, but fascism really is socialism, because Mussolini was the first fascist, and he was the head for many years of the Italian socialist newspaper. So there's no difference between fascism and socialism. It's an organized planned society where those in charge will run a government, a heavy bureaucratic government, where every facet of life will be regulated and planned, and you'll be regulated from birth to death as to what you do, what you'll work at, even to what your hobbies will be, basically, at the end, yeah.
That's kind of fascinating, why they would want to micromanage humans down to that level.
Mm-hmm. Again, it fits different categories. If you understand, again, that as I say, bankers love socialism. I used to wonder why the supposed working people that seem to pay most of the taxes, their representatives in government for labor or democracy, democratic parties, were so adamant that they wanted taxation, thinking it'd be spread amongst the poor, etc. It never happened. And then I caught on to the fact that the bankers live on debt collection and interest on debt. So therefore, bankers must have perpetual debt. And therefore, they love socialism. That's why they fund socialism. And you'll find that in Britain, in the late 1800s, when they created the precursor of the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, they founded a society, the Cecil Rhodes Society, and every member pretty well in that society that became the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the CFR, every founding member was a banker. And they pretty well ran a parallel government up to the present time. You find most top politicians are all Council on Foreign Relations members. In Britain, it is called the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And they have branches across the whole planet now. They have one for the whole of the European Union, a European Council on Foreign Relations. So this is a parallel government, and it's not a conspiracy theory, because Professor Carl Quigley, who wrote Tragedy and Hope, and who was an advisor to the State Department for many years, was also the historian for the Council on Foreign Relations. So he wrote about them in the Anglo-American Establishment and Tragedy and Hope, the two main books that he wrote. And he said that they are a parallel government. They're not responsible to the public. They have one agenda. They work behind the scenes. They wield the true power. They're not answerable to the public. And so they can get all the jobs done for integration and creating this world system, a world government, basically.
Is there any kind of law that they follow amongst themselves? Are you following what I'm saying? Are they based upon any kind of a structural law?
Well, what they believe in is, again, it's a It's a eugenics system. They truly believe in Darwinism, number one. They believe that if the lesser types in society were to outbreed the intellectual and wealthy elite, then we'd bring them down. The public would bring the elite down. And that cannot happen. We'd end up in some sort of dark age, they claim. Therefore, it's their right to rule over the rest of the people and gradually bring down the populations by any means possible. See, we don't realize that a war can take many forms at the same time. They've used the culture industry, for instance, to alter culture drastically. And so the same organization said back in the early, in fact, in the late 1800s, H.G. Wells talked about the necessity, and he was a member of this group, he talked about the necessity of creating free love to in order to abolish marriage. Because he said only then will governments be able to dictate right down to the individual without family members or tribal members standing in the way or standing up for the person. Therefore, you'd be defenseless when government will talk directly to you. You look around for help and there's no one there. That was part of it, divide and conquer. But also, they wanted to get access to children and offspring so that the state could indoctrinate the children, and a parent or parents, especially with the man out the way, were less likely to put in what they call their contaminated values, old-fashioned contaminated values into the child. The state would be responsible for bringing up the child.
Is that when they came about with a lot of the organizations like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts? Camp
exactly. Okay. Absolutely, yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. That was the reason for it. In fact, Julian Huxley, who was the first CEO of the United Nations, UNESCO, and that whole thing was to do with a new indoctrination of children worldwide into a new culture. He was the brother of Aldous Huxley, and by the way, they're both descended and related to Darwin. Julian Huxley talks about that. He said that once the family unit was abolished, and it's even said the fact that we can sterilize the public while at the same time they give them a very permissive age where they could play with each other as much as they wanted to, but there'd be no offspring. And he also said that the elite could have the antidote to that which they're giving to sterilize the public. Well, we look what's happened since 1950s, for instance, with the initial inoculations that came out for so many things. Male sterility in the Western world, males are down 75 to 85% sterile right now, according to all the medical journals that are out today. And the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation did a very good documentary on this. It's called The Disappearing Male, and I have the link on my website in the audio section. This is no coincidence. When you see the very, very things that the top people advocated in their think tanks, in their global meetings of their day, and they're all scientists, and then you see the effects happening in society, you have to put two and two together and say, well, things like this don't suddenly happen. Something's happened to the people. Was it the food? Was it the water? Was it the injections? But something happened. And the United Nations now, every year, gives statistics on the decline of the sperm count in the Western male. And as I say, the last one was down to about 85%. They found that only two teenage males now in 20 have what they call motive cells that have enough life to move. And even then, those two out of 20 only have about 10% that are workable to fertilize a woman. This is from the national statistics and the international statistics.
So, and now I can see where they're probably really wanting to track that sort of thing, too.
Yes, and the odd thing is, they never call it a crisis. But whenever they come out with the statistics, every year they quote us the statistics, they never say this is a crisis. Now, obviously they don't call it a crisis because it's planned that way. If it was outside of their control, believe you me, they would call it a crisis.
So what do you think of those vaccinations that have been funded? Is it UN funding that's involved with Bill Gates and them in those third world countries? Are they involved together in this? In those?
Yes, the World Health Organization is part of the United Nations. And remember, the United Nations also has a Department of Population Control. If people can't figure out that an organization that was set up to control the population of the world is going around the world giving out inoculations for free, and they can't get the hairs on the back of their neck standing up, then it's too bad, you know. Because you should never trust them. You can't trust anyone like that who's got a particular agenda on the one side while they want to help you on the other. It doesn't mesh somehow. We do know that the World Health Organization sterilized, actually said millions of women in India and Africa a few years back by giving them out what they claimed were free tetanus shots, pregnant women, and pre-pregnant women. Somehow something was in it that went right to the ovaries, caused massive inflammation, and fibrostome caused sterilization. The UN eventually admitted this.
Mm-hmm.
So why on earth would you ever trust them? Now, people in the West hear this and they'll say, oh, well, we're okay here, you know. I mean, we're not those people over there. You see, those primitive people. That's how we think, unfortunately.
Well, Planned Parenthood. That way. Planned Parenthood's another form, isn't it?
But of course, what we don't realize is that the globalists at the top are internationalists. They have no fondness for even the countries they're born in. They are internationalists and they are elitists. And they see the peasants of the U.S., Canada, Mexico, and China, or India, in the same category. There's no difference between them. We're just the excess masses left over from an industrial age, and we don't have the employment that we used to have. Therefore, we're really superfluous.
So when you were talking about the Rhodes Foundation, do you want to get in a little bit about what they are and who may be members?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Rhodes Foundation was supposedly set up by Cecil Rhodes because he was enamored at Oxford University by a professor who was teaching that Britain should be the nucleus, and the British system should be the nucleus of a world society based on free trade and based on the same governmental system. Now, in his day, Britain had a massive empire. They already had that nucleus of a world government. And in the countries of their empire, they'd set up mini governments modeled on the British system with big bureaucracies and so on. And the idea was then to set up a form of world government that would appear to be distanced from the British Empire, and that was called the League of Nations that came in with World War I. And all of those in the Cecil Rhodes Foundation went into the building and setting up of the League of Nations. And at the same time they set up the League of Nations, they also changed their name to the Milner Society. That was Lord Milner, Lord Alfred Milner, who was a big banker. And the Cecil Rhodes Foundation joined him. Cecil Rhodes Foundation was also co-sponsored by the Rothschild family. That's in Cecil Rhodes' own will, which is publicly available, you know, from the society. And they became the Royal Institute for International Affairs. So they hoped at that time that the League of Nations would be the nucleus, that be the overlord, the front man that they would rule through, basically. But it didn't work so well, especially the U.S. Citizenry. They didn't want it, although President Wilson actually spearheaded. He was given the task to spearhead and set up the League of Nations. But the public didn't like it. They knew they would lose sovereignty. And so World War II came along. And then, of course, they set up the United Nations during World War II. and they all signed their agreements in 45 and 46 to make it the world, a form of world government. And that's still happening. We don't realize that the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, we've been hearing all about from the G20 boys, are all parts of the United Nations. They all come under that umbrella. And so the UN is now being brought up to its proper place, as it was designed to be, as a form of world government, with a massive bureaucracy in it, in fact, ready to deal with this. And it's going to be economic. It'll deal with all economic affairs. It'll deal with all social affairs, all regulations of houses, areas, districts, populations, etc. It's already doing that, in fact. We don't realize that every law to do with your electrical codes, your housing codes, septic tax, whatever it is, comes from the United Nations and has for the last 10 years.
And the document that tells that?
Oh, yes. And there's an article published only a year ago about an organization that they had set up now in the U.S. and Canada with these inspectors that go out and inspect different properties, etc., to see if they're up with the present building codes, and they report directly to the United Nations.
And is that Agenda 21 that those come under the
yes.
umbrella? Okay.
Agenda 21 falls right in line with sustainable development, depopulation over a period of time, and a managed society where they want to clear everyone out of the rural areas and put them into the already overcrowded cities while that generation basically lives and then dies off, and they hope to have a much reduced population in the future, step by step in the true Fabian tradition. And I must admit that it's actually working. It is actually working. If it wasn't for massive immigration coming into Europe, the U.S. and Canada, our populations would be much, much smaller. Our cities become overcrowded only because, again, under the United Nations and Agenda 21, with the cooperation of governments, governments have not been expanding cities for years. All the so-called urban sprawl was stopped years ago and planning permission was refused. Therefore, you have millions of people moving every year from third world countries into the first world countries, into already overcrowded cities that have not expanded. And it gives the impression of being even more overpopulated simply because there's too many people in a small place.
I've run into that argument by numerous people, and there's a lot of people that really do think that the world is overpopulated, but I think they're kind of mimicking what they've heard. Because I don't know.
Yes, they are, because most television programs you watch now on nature shows or public broadcasting are nothing more than propaganda. And excuse me. And what you find is that the marketers at the top have said that the public has to hear something at least 8 times before they start to repeat it. And if you go into any show today on nature shows or whatever, they'll always bring in sustainable development, and climate change. Until, just by speaking the propaganda, it appears to be real to the public. It's through repetition alone. And Lord Bertrand Russell, who was one of the big boys for the Royal Institute for International Affairs, said that in his own books. He helped set up the system of social control through the mind, basically, and culture creation. And they said we must bring on Madison Avenue and the advertisers and so on, those who already understand how to alter behavior and get them to motivate the public along this agenda, and it will be done through masses of propaganda.
And was he a member of this one of these groups, or several of them?
Pardon?
Was Bertrand Russell a member of some of these groups?
Political groups?
Mm-hmm. Like
oh, yeah,
CFR.
He was a member, too, of the Fabian Society.
Okay.
And then when they decided to split off into fragments and pretend they didn't know each other because they have other specialized areas that appear to even oppose each other in public, he left them, and he wrote mainly on philosophy and mathematics and socialism for many years after he left the Fabian Society, but in reality he was still working for them. It's now been disclosed that Lord Bertrand Russell and many others of those people in his era in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s were actually employed by MI5 and MI6. At the time, that's only been declassified in mainstream books now.
Interesting.
Recently.
And so in order for an organization to be a non-governmental organization, they have to be come under the umbrella of Agenda 21 or the UN, correct?
Yes, the UN has authorized NGOs. Now, there are millions of NGOs. Most of them don't get accredited with the UN. You have to go along with all of the UN's agenda to be brought on board.
But in order for them to get there...
So they're selective, yeah.
Okay. Because I guess I was understanding that you know, in order for them to get their charter or whatever, they still had to come under the UN criteria. Now, whether they get picked up as a major organization under the UN would be something
else. Well,
the
UN set out Agenda 21.
Right, right.
Yeah, and what they do as well, then the UN that controls a lot of the NGOs, not all of them, but they control a lot of them. They get the NGOs to work through various organizations back in their own countries. You'll find members that belong to Agenda 21 for the NGOs sitting in your local councils and teachers and education in local schools and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what do you think they're trying to accomplish at this G20?
The G20, as I say, was a formality. You understand that the present economic system up to the present was designed by the same group about 50 years ago by John Maynard Keynes when they had the Bretton Woods Agreement, and they came to the Bretton Woods Accord, as they called it, and they basically altered the money system at that time. They did away pretty well with the gold standard. They had called it fractional reserve, where you only needed a little bit of gold, even though you could loan out all this paper. But John Maynard Keynes, who was a top sociologist as well, he knew that money was really a form of social control. It's always been a form of social control. That's why the bankers are really in control, the top international bankers, I should say. And he said that this is part one of an agreement. He says we, the signers and the founders, will not see our utopia realized for about 50 years. So there was another part of the agreement to come. And funnily enough, I was talking about that then, just before the G20, it was announced in major newspapers in Britain, Bretton Woods Part 2, that went right along with what I just said.
Mm-hmm.
And at the G20, they've talked about bringing the International Monetary Fund up to its proper status, that which it was created to do. And that is to really regulate the currencies of all countries worldwide. So this G20 was a formality really to bring that in. That was the main part of their agreement. The other part was to further cement the European Union with the North American Union, because part of this agreement is with Amalgamated Americas, that right now it's US, Canada, Mexico. We now become amalgamated with Europe and we'll all be under the IMF. That's all part of this particular deal. And about 2 weeks before the G20, maybe 3 or 4 weeks before the G20, Mr. Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, talked about that. He said that now that we have the United Americas, this union, the next move is to amalgamate with the European Union. Eventually, maybe next year or a couple of years later, we'll all amalgamate as America's Europe with the Far Eastern Union as well, and then you're totally under global government.
So in other words, you're saying that he was saying we were already the North American Union.
Yeah, oh yes. And we had it in the newspapers in Canada about 2 years ago. They called it a massive spread in the newspapers one day. They called it Fortress America. And under that title in the newspapers, I think I even have the link on my website again.
Go ahead and give your website if you want.
Yeah, cuttingthroughthematrix.com. They can find it there. They can also go into Alan Watts Sentient Sentinel.eu for the European version. But in there they'll find that link for Fortress America, and it's about a two-page spread where the president of the U.S. and the prime minister of Canada and the one from Mexico got together, and they talked about the amalgamation of the economy, the taxation system, bureaucratic exchange between the federal governments, literally saying that it was designed so that Canadian bureaucrats at the federal level and the U.S. ones could exchange places and even apply for work there, back and forth. Import taxes were all to be shared, customs would all be shared, and intelligence services would be integrated completely. And they said in the article that most of that had already been done under the Fortress America, using the guise of terrorism, that it was inevitable. But they also said that it was necessary for us all to unite and integrate. And this is the excuse that I said years ago would happen, to compete with the European Union and China. They couldn't do it alone as separate countries. We'd have to come together and compete with these big blocks. In other words, we've got to become a block to compete with a block. That was the excuse that was given at the time.
Does that mean that we would be utilizing a parliamentary system within our government then?
Like yes, absolutely. And strangely enough, I was reading an article just the other day there from the United States and from one of the Council on Foreign Relations members in the U.S. stating that they need a new form of a governmental system. But you can go back to the free trade negotiations that were going in the late 80s for the NAFTA. Free trade came first, free trade negotiations, and then the NAFTA, North American Free Trade Association meeting came afterwards. But in both of those meetings, they talked about setting up a province or a state to house the new North America's parliament. And they even discussed at the time, it was in the newspapers here, they thought that Montreal might fit the bill.
Well, I ran into a site, and I don't know if there was any relation or not, but if you type in usparliament.org or usparliament.com, yep, they speak of these divisions and something about super states.
Yes. Yes, super state, again, it comes from super cities. There was a UN mandate a few years ago, in Canada definitely, and maybe in the States as well, I don't know. But in Canada, they started to amalgamate all the smaller cities around the main cities into one big super city. And again, they called it, this would lead to super state status, etc., etc. So everything that happens in the U.S. happens in Canada at the same time, as it does as well in Europe at the same time. It's been like that for years now.
Well, it's so like your Council of Governments and intergovernment.
Yes, and you can also look into the Summit of the Americas. That's another organization run by Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rockefeller runs five organizations, along with the Council on Foreign Relations, for the amalgamation of the Americas through his foundation grants, etc. And he speaks at them, too.
Well, they also try to... I guess there was a document called Global Governance. Have you read that before?
Oh, yes. There's many documents out on it. In fact, they talked about global governance at the G20 meeting, and that's the term they called it, global governance, yeah.
Okay, and in that global governance, they actually create... They're trying to bring in all the resources of the world under one roof.
That's right.
Yeah, and one of them is water. And somewhere I was seeing where the UN was trying to get a hold of the water here in North America, and I haven't heard a finalization on that yet, but something was in the works, a year or two ago. Have you heard anything more on that?
Yes, the most of the states have negotiators to do with water. See, the water eventually, in fact, all resources had to be taken over eventually by specialists. And Carl Quigley went into this. He said that this new system that comes in, to us it will appear public-private cooperation or amalgamation, you might say. But in reality, it'll be a new feudal system where the CEOs of international corporations will be the new feudal overlords. That's how it really will eventually become. as they amalgamate governments, banks, all this stuff together. But it started in Britain again back maybe 10, 12 years ago. Some members of Parliament put a bill forward to start to take over the British Waterworks Association for all the water supplies for the towns and cities. And the bill passed, it went through to privatize what was owned by the taxpayer, supposedly. They love to create things by the taxpayer, then privatize them. And these same politicians then left office and became the heads of this one corporation that then would own the entire water supply of Britain. But this same company is spreading outwards. It's in Canada, it's in other countries now too. They're into gas and also water right now. Eventually you'll have a particular corporation that will deal with water. One will deal with food. Right now there's about four or five, like Archer Daniels Midlands, that deals with the food supply of the planet. They'll eventually amalgamate into one, so they'll own the entire agriculture for the planet. So everything that you need will be owned by a separate, or seemingly separate, international corporation, basically. That, again, was an idea that came from Marx, Karl Marx. Everything, in fact, that Karl Marx wrote about is coming into play right now.
That's what I understand.
In Russia, for instance, you had maybe one main factory that would make the shoes for the entire Russia. One factory made the toothbrushes for the entire of the Soviet Union. This is the way they're setting it up, under the guise of efficiency.
So, I mean, what I'm seeing, some of these I had several hundred life insurance companies or, you know, insurance companies there at some point where they'd had health and life, and now they're, you know, they got to a point down there was probably a handful. I think it's expanded a little somewhat again, but in the what I see them doing, how are they talking to these companies to go along with this and fund their own demise? Are they lying to them like they are the rest of us?
A lot of them, you find, again, it was started in Britain when they had the corporate raiders, they called them. These are guys who went and looked at the stocks of different companies and who really owned them. And they would come in through the back door and start buying up different stocks until they themselves would be the main shareholder. They've been at this game for an awful long time. Even big companies that you thought were still family-owned often did not have the controlling shares. And these boys would come in under different names. Maybe five different guys would buy up shares, but they all belonged to the one boss. And then they would claim that they now had the controlling shares. They've been at this for an awful long time, taking over. So whoever owns the shares basically directs the policy of the company, ultimately, via the shareholders' wishes.
Well, because what I envision them doing is, okay, you've got so many water companies out there going out there and privatizing the water around the world, mm-hmm. But at some point in time, those will probably all be combined under one.
Yes,
monopolistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is the plan. The first step was to get the public to, number one, they put so many laws out there to try and forbid you from thinking that you own your own well, number one. But it's okay for corporations to apparently own your well and everyone else's well. That seems to be okay. That tells you there's something up here, you know, something else on the agenda. See, water and food, etc., they're essential to life. They've been used for warfare purposes for thousands of years. You cut off the city's water, you cut off their food supply, and you wait to starve them to death, or they will either that or they surrender and come out on their hands and knees and do everything you want. That's how, it's a form of control over the public. All the vital things that you need to be independent must be taken away from you so that you're interdependent. This term is, again, a United Nations buzzword you hear all the time. We're interdependent. That means that everything that you need, you depend on this system to supply it to you. You cannot do it on your own. Yeah.
And so like the instance of Walmart becoming such a huge giant that it is, was... Mm-hmm. Probably, you know, pre-planned and set up and facilitated,
yes,
by those mm-hmm. trade groups and that sort.
Yes, that's one of the many big chains they set up. Again, I saw it in Europe years ago before it really blossomed across the States. And from everything, I even saw them, little towns or of a few thousand people would have a few vegetable stores, for instance, and then would come one massive one. They'd undercut everybody for maybe a year, 2 years, put them all out of business, and then jack all their prices up once they had no competition. The same technique's been used for years now through hardware stores and everything else that you need until you've got one main supplier in your town for pretty well anything and everything. But there's no competition now. And in fact, the variety as well dwindles because you don't have separate salesmen coming around from little manufacturers anymore. These big companies like Walmart only buy from their specified purchasers, and it's a limited stock. Therefore, what you see in Walmart, you'll see in every other major chain. There's no difference in anything, but they have the whole market sewn up, and they can jack their prices up, and you simply have to pay if you want that item.
And so is that what took place in Soviet Russia then?
That's right. Soviet Russia, supposedly the state, and technically, in a sense, the state owned everything. Technically, even in modern China, the state owns everything. You'll have people fronting for organizations, but people's army technically owns everything since the Chinese government is also the bank for all loans. And they also want to cut back on all sales, etc. That kind of is a system they're going to bring in worldwide, a socialist system. And we see the thing happening here, as I say, when governments now own big stocks in banks, for instance, you're seeing the blending of private corporations and the economic guys with government, your government. And this is simply a further step into what they first called public-private partnerships. The public-private partnerships is how they first introduced this idea to the public from the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And Prince Charles even was the first guy they brought out in Britain to announce it to the public. They got him to do that job. And it's a form of fascism, as I say, when you have a public, meaning your government, working with big private organizations to create public policy. You've got fascism, plain and simple. And fascism, as I say, is just another name, as far as I'm concerned, after studying the history of it, for socialism.
Yeah. So it's about control and about having a monopoly and no competitiveness as far as creating any kind of product or lifestyle that could be better because of innovation.
Yeah, their intention is not to... See, we're born and we're kind of raised, or we used to be raised, to think that each individual could decide for themselves what kind of life they wanted to live, and as long as it doesn't interfere with anyone else's. And it's not that way under a socialist system. Under a socialist system, you must serve the world state. In fact, in the Council on Foreign Relations and Neurology for International Affairs, they said that eventually people will be born. Your only duty will be to serve the world state. Serve is the key word. And I thought it very interesting that Obama there brought in that term as well, of service for the youth. This is all part of the same movement at different levels, but it's the exact same movement all going towards the same ultimate goal. So you're not really here to serve yourself anymore or to figure things out for yourself or do what you want. You're really here to serve this world-planned society. That's what they mean by that. That's also what they mean by good citizenship.
But in some respects, I also notice that technology isn't necessarily not there, but it seems like it's not available to the public.
Oh, yeah. Well, really, we're kept in the dark about everything, unless it's a public announcement from the G20. And even then, they'll speak cryptically to the masses who don't understand their terminology. At the G20, the Prime Minister, Brown, and it's been in all the newspapers here, he declared, it's up on YouTube, in fact, you'll hear him saying the speech, I get the link on my site too, he says this is a new world order. He uses the very term, this is a new world order. And he says, we shall create chaos, order out of chaos. That's their big motto, is in the Scottish Rite of Freemasons, order out of chaos. First you create the chaos, and then you bring them the solution that you already planned. I couldn't believe it when he said that. I thought, well, it's right in the open now, but the public haven't a clue what he's really saying.
And I'm finding him slipping a lot of the verbiage into our everyday language.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about in one of your interviews about the movie The Soviet Story.
Yes.
What impressed you most about that when you looked at that?
The first thing I think most people will realize is how much was hidden from the Western world. Even it's still hidden, really, because that the Prime Minister, the President of Russia, Mr. Putin, tried to ban that movie. He asked the Economic Union to ban it, not show it, because they still don't want us to realize how bad the socialist system truly was, with its planned mass slaughter, etc. And in the movie, you'll hear professors discuss socialism more openly and honestly for the first time as to what it really is, the planned society. One professor says whenever they take over, they pretty well automatically kill off about 30% of the populace as they restructure the society into the new type that they want, the new model that they want. But they show you such horrific scenes of mass extermination, a planned extermination, a genocide of whole countries. I mean, the Ukrainians lost millions of people because Stalin literally... In socialism, they believe in evolution. And what they said was that those people who were peasants were two or three generations behind the more advanced countries. They'd never catch up, through massive indoctrination. Therefore, they'd have to eliminate them, or they would contaminate those that were progressing. That's what they said. So the idea came, they would literally take all the food from the producers, because the Ukrainians were massive producers of wheat and corn and so on. And they did. A massive program was launched, and they took their food from them, and the people starved to death. That was planned genocide. Much, much worse than happened in World War II, Germany. Millions more were killed, and I think even today, the official stats that come out from some sources will say 80 million were killed in the entire regime from 1917 up to the present, up to the 1990. But other figures put it about 160 million. But I think the Ukrainians lost well over 6 to 8 million people and planned hunger, starvation. Yeah. And all the food that they produced that was taken by the Soviets under this plan was exported to the Western countries at the same time. That's all in that particular video.
Yeah. Now, is there a good film out on the history of the Soviet... Well, I don't want to say Sovietizing, but the China's version of how they became communist or socialist?
There's bits and pieces and little videos you'll see, but they're mainly university sites to do with the Cultural Revolution, that part of it in China, which is interesting too. But see, communism was not something that just took hold like fire across the world. In the 1800s, as I say, there were many big, well-financed organizations that tried to bring in a sort of world socialism. Then eventually it blossomed into the fast route. The fast route was called communism, which Lenin said himself, and Stalin, that communism was just socialism in a hurry. But what was interesting was that big boys, again, that already were creating the cultures for the West, planning it in think tanks, international meetings, like Bertrand Russell. In his own memoirs, he said he was sent over to pre-communist China to teach in the universities to set up the embryo and the thinking for the coming communism. So he was preaching communism to the Chinese to tell them how to set it up. Communist countries were all financed by the Western powers and the Western banks. That is documented.
Well, haven't they kind of been under their control for a long time?
I think the Chinese have never really... See, China has never known true freedom. It's got a very ancient history. What you do find, if you look at their ancient history, they were the first ones to try forms of communism, socialism, fascism, etc. All the isms, they're all really just variants of the one. A free enterprise, even a couple of thousand years ago, they were trying all of these out. So they were even keeping their histories on how they worked. And I'm sure they've been used for re-implementation even today. But China's never been a country for individualism. Even today, it's not really an individualistic country.
Let me go ahead and say that you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody and on KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And if you want to get a listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, you can go to www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And my guest tonight is Alan Watt, and he has his own program on RBN, Republic Broadcasting Network. And then he also has his own website on Cutting Through the Matrix. And there he has a lot of his audio files and extensive audio files and books that are available. And that's how he gets supported. Anything else you want to add to that, Alan?
That's about it. As I say, it's such a massive, vast topic that you can't cram it in when there's so much to go over. To try and give people who don't know terribly much outside the mainstream media or their own education how big this is and how it's been on the go for an awful long time. Nothing in the world happens by chance on a massive scale. It takes a lot of planning and negotiations for any major thing to occur. And when we look at what we think is a financial crash, is it really all an accident, or is it simply part of the next part of the agenda? The bankers aren't losing, as we notice. They're guaranteed not all the money that went to money heaven, but they're also guaranteed the money they claim that they lost by the taxpayer. And we find the big players again, the big world socialists like Hillary Clinton, stating, and she's up on YouTube saying it, she says we can use this financial crisis for our advantage.
Well, Rahm Emanuel does the same too, doesn't he?
Exact same thing. So when you hear a lot of people at the top saying the same thing, you know it's part of the agenda. Because how else could they bring up the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to its supposed proper status unless they did something like this? And of course, Britain was the first country to deregulate the economic system, basically, let the free market just roll unimpeded. The U.S. followed suit. They knew darn well that if no one was watching them, then the sky was the limit with the big bubbles. So they created it. They created the situation years ago, and it happened exactly as planned. And then they turned around and say, "My goodness, we're all surprised. We'll have to get the World Bank involved here as a more efficient controller." And the IMF will come up to its proper status. It's all planned this way.
Well, they even planned these. It isn't just a few years in advance. Some of these are couple hundred years in advance, are
yes.
they not? Yeah. And I was hearing the Chinese may even go as far as 1,000 years in advance.
Yes. As I say, there's nothing really new because knowledge is never destroyed or forgotten by those in control. Knowledge is power. Especially when it's power to do with the workings of human nature, how to control populations, guide populations. They never lose that. And I used to wonder, in fact, why these big institutions, these foundations, used top philosophers and historians for hundreds of years to help guide parliaments and governments. And of course, it's because they pull them in. They say, "Well, this happened 1,000 years ago. This king did this, and he wanted the country to go this direction. How did they do it?" And then they go back all the way even to Plato and say, "Well, it's all done by formula." And Plato knew this too. It's formula. When each for example, a simple formula is exactly what did happen. Deregulate the banks, encourage them to go for the sky with massive profits and bubble industries, basically, bubble stocks. Dress them up all fancy, but it's still nonsense to begin with. There's nothing there to begin with. It's all marketing and selling and marketing and selling, and to get massive bubbles. And then, of course, it will have to fall by itself. When customers come in and ask for their money, well, guess what? You know, the stock will be as valueless. And the number one, I read from a book from a top economist that worked with governments. He said it was irreligious, he said, or sacramental, sacrilege. Be sacrilege for an economist ever to give the bad news to the public. They must always lie to the and say everything is fine. When your president comes out, the top man, and tells you all to panic because this could cause a depression worse than the last Great Depression, that's intentional. And it was from President Bush's statements that suddenly, sure enough, that's when everybody grabbed their money and asked for it back out of the stocks, etc., and the whole thing crashed. This was designed this way. Otherwise, Mr. Bush would have said it's fine, and we'd believe him.
Well, one of the interesting parts about that I find is first they'll act like they don't want the information out, and they will do everything they can, even eliminate people to keep certain information coming out. And then it's gotten to the point now where you see that they leak it out through certain sources, mm-hmm. and or it's like they're it's like a mental conditioning before they announce that they're going to do something.
It is. It's treating the public in a sense. They put up a trial balloon, and we take things in almost on a subconscious basis. Much of the news that we hear, but your mind will remember that initial. It's called predictive programming in psychology.
Uh-huh.
Your mind hears it, and then a month later they'll come out with some more on that same thing, and. And then a third thing comes out, and then eventually you're convinced of it, but you've never rationally understood it, you've never rationally thought it through or reasoned it for yourself. You simply come to the conclusion that's presented to you by the media at the very end of it. That's predictive programming. You train, they train us like animals. It's Pavlovian techniques they actually use on the public. Yeah.
Right, and then they love the Hegelian dialectics too, and that's a fun one trying to overcome.
Yes.
when you're out there trying to educate the public and then you got to get them to understand that, well, no, it's not what you think it is.
Yes, and again, the Hegelian technique takes the premise that society by itself would become a static society. It wouldn't change. Now, most of us would say that's fine. Don't make it any worse than it is. Just stop right here. But remember, if you have an agenda, you've got to have constant change in society. So you must create the organization that will come forth with the demands for a change. Now you know you're going to have resistance amongst the populace in what they're going to say. So you supply the opposition to yourself, pretending to speak on behalf of the populace. And then the two of you will negotiate, and then there'll be compromise. Now compromise for the populace is defeat. You've given something up. And it's easier to give up the next part with the next compromise and the next compromise. In other words, you can't start and take the first compromise with these guys. These guys are ruthless. They will always get what they want, piece by piece in the Fabian system and techniques.
Well, when you
therefore, you cannot negotiate away any rights whatsoever at the beginning. Unfortunately, we're way beyond that point now.
Right, with these round tables and these consensus meetings and various other tactics that they utilize. I mean, they're training people in this type of process, and it comes down to the local levels that all meetings are carried out through this public input process that goes through the same agenda.
Yes, but we are out of the picture anyway. In fact, much of the public are trained that there are organizations out there, official organizations, that speak on your behalf. And that is the pretense, of course, that is put out there by the non-governmental organizations. they pretend to speak on behalf of the people. We don't elect them. And they're all given their instructions by the big foundations, like the, let's say, the Rockefeller Foundation, Ford, Carnegie, etc.
So everything, even like our educational system, our health system, our governments, our everything within our lives has been thought out by some think tank or other, and micromanaged down to the to every aspect of our life.
Yes, you got to understand that if you want to take over a country or a world, you must then stand back like a like an alien who has never seen it before, and simply study it, watch it, watch every facet of society, what society needs, what categories of society need, what's different between them, how are their interactions, how do they spend their time, how do they adapt to different educations, and it's quite simple then to through culture, industry, and creation and media and the educational system. That's why you have an international educational authority under UNESCO. Then it's quite easy then to reprogram the public along a certain path with every intake of children into school. Each intake is further along in indoctrination than the previous intake. It's that perfect, yeah.
And so why would you think that they would be so apt to utilize such negatory treatment of humans as opposed to doing it with positive reinforcement?
Because they do see us like animals. Remember, at the top, at the foundations that help finance all these NGOs, the same foundations that are the parallel government, that's what they were set up to be, to fund the NGOs as a parallel government. They believe in eugenics. In fact, if you go back into their histories, the American Eugenics Society in the U.S. was set up by the Carnegie Foundation and then overtaken and run by the Rockefeller Foundation. So eugenics and Darwinism is a big, big part of this world socialist agenda. And going back to what I said earlier, Karl Marx wanted to dedicate his third publication of his book to Darwin, because Darwin helped validate their agenda, their socialist agenda, where the intellectual elite, the fittest, should rule the lessers, basically.
Well, didn't they also do some kind of inbreeding of sorts?
Yeah, they do. In fact, Charles Darwin himself was the product of inbreeding, because he, his father, and his grandfather, and maybe more before him, I don't know, had only taken wives from one other family, and that was the Wedgwood family in England. Now, that's just the Darwins doing this special selective breeding. When Charles Darwin's wife died at Wedgwood, he married his mother's sister, so a Wedgwood as well. Today, you have Anthony Wedgwood Benn, who has been up in the British politics after his father, Lord Benn, who are also descended from the Wedgwoods and the Darwins. I mean, these things still go on, you know. And they were just one main family. And you'll find some of the biggest radical, or people who've radically changed society and education in the past, like the Darwins, have been involved in special breeding programs as well.
Well, when you were talking about the Chinese somewhat, we've got Maurice Strong that lives over in this area, but I'm pretty much aware that he's over in China at this point in time.
Yes.
Do you think he's doing a lot of his spreading of the Agenda 21 aspect over there at this point?
Yes. Maurice Strong was picked up by Rockefeller when he was a young man and groomed by Rockefeller personally to do what he's doing. And he's been at the head of the World Bank, he's been the head of different UN parts and foundations, etc. And even now he's still working for the UN in China to do with not just the cultural aspect of China and the alteration of the cultural part of it as it blend with the West, but also to do with the trade part as well. But what's interesting was that a documentary was done by Public Broadcasting. It may have been the CBC before then, I don't know. But at one Sunday afternoon when it was raining, I watched it a few years ago, two or three years ago, and they showed you Maurice Strong and at his age, still putting in 12 hours a day at work and so on. And a little cutaway in the thing, he went to a graveyard in China to put flowers at his aunt's grave. And his aunt's grave was buried next to Mao Zedong.
Are you talking about Anna? Anna's grave?
Yeah, and it said that a great friend of the revolution, she was an advisor to Mao Zedong. So these families have been professional revolutionaries down through at least the last couple of hundred years, probably.
Well, I was looking up a little bit into Al Gore's background, and his family was heavily involved with Russia, correct?
Oh, heavily involved, and Armand Hammer also groomed him. Armand Hammer of the big Armand Hammer company. In fact, the father changed his name to symbolize the arm and the hammer of the Soviet communist system. And he took that surname. But Armand Hammer had a suite next to Lenin and then Stalin. At the same time, he go back to the U.S. Unimpeded to both countries during the supposed revolutionary period, etc., and post-revolutionary period. To see the West set up the Soviet Russia. Trotsky himself came from New York with the money that was to set it up. He was caught at Halifax customs with the money on board a ship, and President Wilson was told to get him a passport quickly. He sent a courier up to Halifax, and he was given a U.S. citizenship passport, and the Canadians let him go. He went over to Germany with the money, went all the way up through Russia, and that was what funded the revolution. So the bankers did it. And you'll find that the big Baruchs and so on and different banks were behind the complete funding of the Soviet revolution.
So you're finding that a lot of the current leadership still heavily ties back into the past histories of these various supposedly opposing countries and regimes.
Absolutely. It was a classical dialectic. Russia itself would have starved to death in the early days too. There was so much American aid going over, primarily American aid, shoes, clothing, everything to keep them alive during the first few years. The Red Cross was involved, the Salvation Armies. There was even an America-Russia Help Society set up by the U.S. government. We don't realize how much we put into keeping them communist. And then, of course, once they were up and running, we fed them right up until the Berlin Wall collapsed, because they couldn't even grow enough to feed themselves.
Well, they had a tendency to play down a lot of the, if I'm recalling this correctly, a lot of the technology of the Russians, but once they combined in those technologies particularly, I mean, they may have been much further ahead than we even know, but at this point in time, they're so amalgamated in their space program, and it sounds like they're much, much further along than we even have a clue as to what's going on. I was just looking at a website for a symposium going on in Colorado Springs last week, and I mean, they were talking about the space tourism as though it was already a functioning functioning entity. I don't know how much so, but I sure would have loved to have been a fly on the wall.
Yes, even before the Berlin Wall came down, that the U.S. already had a U.S.-Soviet program, combined program, working. And I used to be astonished as to how, when you read any books on the Cold, written during the Cold War, about the Cold War itself, even from universities, they don't have all these great quotes from famous scientists or politicians saying that this is a war of technology, those with the greatest technology will win it. Well, every year from World War II onwards, Britain and Europe and the US and all the other countries sent their top scientists over to Russia for a world science meeting. I said, well, that's the last thing you would do with your best scientists, who no doubt all work for your defense department. Why would you let them mix with their supposed enemies in the Soviet Union? I realized then it was all a farce, that they were sharing the data at the top.
So if you have someone like Maurice Strong over there in China being heavily involved, and he's the one that had set up the Rio Earth Summit, and yet at the same time they're developing China at such an aggressive rate, and over here they're trying to tell us to conserve.
Yeah.
Are they setting them up for something like they're doing to us?
Yes, China You see, once they bring down their population, and this is the key to it, if you look at old movies that were put out as propaganda pieces, but they were very good to watch, entertaining, but as long as you understood that they were predictive programming, you look at the movie, it was called Soylent Green.
Mm-hmm.
Written, I think it was done in about the 60s with Charlton Heston. It came from a book called Make Room, Make Room. It was put out there as a propaganda piece to terrify the public into sterilization, having fewer children, and so on. Or you become overcrowded in the big cities and you have no food and so on. It was a very bleak future they were painting in it. Well, that all came from think tanks that already discussed the whole future. When they had discussed overcrowding the European cities, they discussed this at the end of World War II. In fact, 1946, I think, it was the King George meeting on population control that they all attended. They discussed all of this. And again, you can get the appearance of overpopulation by creating massive immigration, unlimited immigration into pre-existing cities that are not meant to house all of that. And so therefore, you can create little bomb bays everywhere in a major city if you're not allowed to expand the cities. That's exactly what they've done, and so perception becomes truth. In other words, perception is your truth. It's not a reality, it's the truth that you perceive. That was the techniques that they've used. But they talked about a post-industrial Europe, a post-industrial America, and all the useless eaters, as Bertrand Russell called them, that would be left with no function. They couldn't work in high tech, not everyone suited for it. And therefore, they would need a much reduced population. Now, he belonged to the Royal Institute for International Affairs that in the 1930s in their world meetings talked about creating Russia as a world manufacturer for the planet. As we dwindle in population across Europe over the years, now it might take, according to the military think tanks, by 2030, definitely 2050, the population of the world is to drastically start reducing. They don't say why or how it's going to happen. And I've got those particular official military think tank websites up on my site and their documents to do with this. China will also have to be depopulated because it will not need all of that population for manufacturing purposes when the purchasers will be dwindling in numbers as well.
Do you think maybe that the release of the avian flu and that sort of thing may not be so accidental over in China?
Pardon?
The release of the avian flu and that sort of thing that's been going on over there.
Yeah.
The bird flus and that sort.
Yeah. Well, China, remember, in fact, the think tank that advises the British Department of Defense put out a 90-page document, which I have on the website, in audio archives. It was followed up immediately by almost a verbatim report from the U.S., Department of Defense, going along the same futuristic path, what they see happening in the future. And they talk about, as I say, they talk about China drastically starting to depopulate as well as it adopts the ways of the West. Now, they already have what it said in their think tank reports is they're almost, believe it or not, China is almost at the stage where it cannot reproduce itself because of the one child per family policy. If two people have one child, if everybody in a society only had one child, technically within a generation, your population would be reduced by half.
Hmm.
You have to produce two children to keep it static. So they have a one child per family policy. And they also have a governmental implemented mandatory abortion if you're pregnant a second time. And they do drastically follow that out through. Plus, you find in China, suddenly, again, this is the newspapers a couple of weeks ago, and I read this on the air too, China is now seeing massive birth defects in children. Probably because of the industrial pollution there and the chemicals that they're using. They don't have the safeguards we have here, even though we don't have the factories anymore.
Yeah, but aren't they shipping them over here?
They're shipping them over here, but during the processing and all the rest of it, but also because they were so, set up so quickly to be the manufacturer of the world and were given unrestricted freedom to pollute. Many of the rivers are completely stagnant now. There's no life in them at all. And there's been various documentaries have come out where factories pour everything straight into the rivers and everything's died off. And yet the farmers, the main farmers, are still carrying water from the rivers by these buckets and pouring it over their crops, you know. The pole over the back in the two buckets. This was shown by a CBC and a BBC documentary on China and the pollution. And people are dying off because most of their food is contaminated with heavy metals like cadmium, etc., from the water supplies, and they irrigate all their crops with it. It's so bad that the EU and Canada and the States banned all imports at one point of all food from China because it's so heavily contaminated with heavy metals. But I think they may have relaxed it now. And interestingly enough, we found the stuff that was getting sent for dogs and the dog food and the cat food was killing off the animals.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're into eugenics, I would figure that they wouldn't. Why would they want to control it? I mean, it seems to me like that would just help them out.
That's right. So we're dealing with people who are masters at chess at the top. And they see everything as a pragmatic a stopgap to the next step, to the next step, to the next step. And probably it will work out that way. I don't see anything that will stop this. I say negotiations will not stop this. These people don't negotiate. If they do, you've lost something on the way. So probably by the year 2030, you will see a drastic decline in population across the board in the Western world. And we're simply not dying fast enough for the United Nations Population Department. So they might help us along the way with releasing new diseases and so on. Look at the cancer rates today.
Yeah.
Every doctor today who's churned out of the universities is given, they're given no history of statistics from, say, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago that doctors were trained in to do with cancer. Some cancers were incredibly rare. Now they're all common. And they're taught that every person is going to eventually die of cancer. That's going to be normal. And this is how the young doctors are trained to accept that. So why? Why is there such a massive increase in cancers? Why the massive increase in autism, attention deficit, etc., and all the rest of the stuff? Why? When that happens across the board in society within a few years, and the sterilization too, something has been done to the people, either through food, water, or inoculations. Julian Huxley and also Lord Bertrand Russell advocated using all of those methods, including the needle, as they phrased it, the needle, to reduce the population. And I think they've been doing it all along, yeah. Since the 1950s, definitely.
Now, you have often talked about chemtrails or in spraying of the skies. And I had been talking to somebody, or I'd listened to an interview with a lady that had actually sent me some mappings and graphs and stuff. I think it was done by NOAA. And it was kind of showing to me that they not only are they, you know, spraying chemicals. I mean, she has pictures of that sort of the chemtrails up there. But then there's also quite a few weather control programs.
Oh, yes. The weather control programs, some of it's been published in the past. I did two or three shows on Dr. Teller, who was a physicist, the guy who discovered or invented the H-bomb, the hydrogen bomb. And he worked for the U.S. government, and he was so eager to get his name in history, he came up with all kinds of ideas. But one of them, back in the 50s, was to spray the entire atmosphere with metallic particles and use Tesla standing wave technology. We now call it HARP because of the HARP organization, the one in Alaska, and there's 50-odd worldwide. They could then carry waves across the entire planet if need be, definitely across continents, and totally control the weather, because the metallic particles make it far easier and more efficient for these ELF waves to travel. Plus, they could actually triangulate these standing waves. They bounce it off the ionosphere, and they can make it come down in the exact place or area or country or state that they wanted to come down on and totally manipulate the weather. But another effect of it was, and this is written in the United Nations treaty that was signed by all active participants for weather warfare. I think it was signed in 1978. They said that this very technology basically rendered the atom bomb obsolete because it had so much potential capability of controlling nations and country and whole continents if need be. Weather is a fantastic weapon, but they could also put a secondary signal on the HAARP. Now, the HAARP by itself can create earthquakes, and this is, they signed this into the treaty that they wouldn't use it on each other in warfare purposes. But they're allowed, by the way, that it says nothing about using it on their own people. All UN treaties are the same. And therefore, they can create earthquakes, they can create tornadoes, hurricanes, very hot weather, very cold weather, on and on it goes. They could even create tsunamis with it. But they said if they attach a secondary signal to the HAARP signal, piggybacking on it, a certain frequency, they can literally alter the behavior of people. And the report stated that the easiest thing to do with people was to make them very lethargic or make them very tired or depressed or even suicidal. Or they could, just by altering it a little bit within the brain frequency, they could make you hyper-aggressive. So this is a tremendous technology. This falls under what they call technotronic warfare, which Brzezinski talked about in his own book. Now, he was one of the head of the NSA at one point, so he should know.
He was head of the... I didn't realize he was head of NSA.
Yeah, he was a top advisor to the NSA.
Yep. I know he's been doing a lot of advising with the current candidates, his children, I think.
Yes, and he is also a member of the Trilateral Commission that also is part of the CFR group. It's not a separate part. They deal with a much bigger part of it, and a Bilderberger and so on. In his own book, Between Two Ages, he's got a chapter called The Technotronic Era, where he talks about a technique used on the public that will alter their behavior and so on, and the public will be completely unaware of it as technotronic warfare.
It's just amazing. If we have to watch our water, our air, our everything.
What I tell the people is they don't realize that total war is a term used in the military. Total war was declared on all the peoples of the world a long time ago, and they have not been told.
Yeah. Well, I kind of liken it to the revolution will be over the day that we start deciding that, you know, it's time for us to revolt, because the revolution was the revolution of the elites.
Yes, it's true. They're very good at getting us to have revolutions, and we never get what we want at the end of it. Or if we think we do, we really haven't, because shortly we're told otherwise. It goes off in a different direction. But that they've always used revolutions, both bloody revolutions and also cultural revolutions. Most changes in society are done through cultural indoctrination over a gradual period of time. And of course, if you look at what happened really in society from World War II, the speed up of the separation of the generations. They separated the teenagers. In fact, they invented the term teenager to help separate one group from the older ones, so they wouldn't listen to them. That was part of the strategy. The term teenager did not exist before that. And they gave them they marketed a culture to them, fashion, music, and so on. And it simply sped up through the 60s. They came out with something they'd worked on since the 1920s and 30s, when they had the first depression. In the first depression, they tried to bring in a world socialism. Out of that, didn't quite work. But they also gave prohibition. It made booze cans very exciting places for young people to go. They gave them the miniskirt back in the 20s and the Roaring 20s and the Charleston dance and so on. They gave them cocaine along with the booze that was smuggled along there as well. But the fallout was, rather than create a promiscuous society that would not bond, that was the intention of it. Because they know that the more promiscuous society is, the less chance there is of a man or a woman bonding for life with another person. The outcome was that so much unwanted pregnancy, and they put up all of the homes, the boys' towns, and all the rest of it sprung up all over the place, and once for girls to deal with unwanted, they couldn't quite pull it off. Plus, venereal disease was rampant. So they went back to the drawing board, and using the tax money of the Western countries, the taxpayers' money, they've been working on a contraceptive that would be effective. So when they relaunched the same idea, the miniskirts, promiscuous sex, music, drugs in the 60s, they added to it penicillin for the infections, and they also gave contraception. That was a mandate. They'd first tried it in the 20s and then reintroduced it, upgraded it in the 1960s. This is an agenda, yeah.
Well, wouldn't our drug culture had a predecessor kind of like what they did to the Chinese?
The Chinese?
Yeah, with the opium wars and
yes, that's right. I mean, I was looking at the histories of the Kerry family, the Bushes and different ones, the Yale bunch, you know, and it's the same with the Russells in Britain and so on. They all made fortunes when they all got together and drop massive bales of hay every day of opium on the Chinese shores, and basically use drugs to bring down China internally. And people don't realize too that the U.S. And most of the Western powers had bases on the eastern coast of China. These little cantons they created were different than British ones and American ones and so on, until the Boxer Rebellion kicked them all out during fierce fighting. But that was the first attempt that we've seen where drugs were used to destroy a people. But at the same time they were doing it there, the Rothschilds through the Bayer Company and other big bankers, you always find the bankers always are into pharmaceuticals too. They have pharmaceutical companies. This goes all the way back to almost Egypt.
Like Schiff and...
Bayer is the Rothschild one that's still on the go today.
Okay.
They have other ones too, but so they tried to introduce or substitute opium derivatives and opium itself and all kind of in Britain even to try and drug the public there and to go along with a new system. But the beer at that time was so popular and the public houses were meeting places where everybody chatted that it didn't quite take off. But they put opium and derivatives of opium in every kind of medicine you can imagine at that time, trying to addict the population, you know. So they've tried every dirty trick. So it's nothing new about using drugs. I read an article about a year ago on air from a special forces man who, after the special forces, he worked with the U.S. Coast Guard trying to stop drugs coming into the country. When he was in one of the Caribbean countries, or the South American countries, I think it was, he met another special forces guy that he worked with, and this guy says, isn't it ironical? He says, you're working with the Coast Guard to stop drugs being brought into the U.S. He says, I'm working for the U.S. government bringing drugs in.
Well, that's my understanding, is the CIA is, like, really huge. In fact, that's probably funding a lot of our government right at this point in time. Is it
not?
Yeah.
So drugs are always... in fact, I've got an article here in the newspapers, and I've got the video, too, where the president of Mexico admits about the massive drug problem they have, but he says you've got to understand there's obviously organization within the U.S. and authority system, he says, that's allowing all this to come into the U.S. in the quantities that it's coming in. This isn't smuggled through by people swallowing condoms full of cocaine. The supply and the demand in the U.S. is so massive, it's their biggest buyer, that it's been brought in by planes, etc. So this is... And then, of course, we had the Contra deal on the go. That was exposed to the world during the sessions that they were exchanging cocaine for drugs, and the cocaine was being sold on U.S. cities by an approval of this special Pentagon team.
Does China still have a big opium or heroin trade?
They'll still have it, so I'm sure it's cracked down on it, but it will still exist at the top. Britain, because Britain was the first one into the opium crescent and into India and Afghanistan, that's why they're in Afghanistan too. When Bush authorized the regrowing of poppy, which the Taliban had forbidden in Afghanistan, suddenly the heroin, which is a derivative of opium, started flowing into the US again and Europe. And that's one of the biggest cash crops over there now, and it's given protection by the U.S. military and the Canadian military. Britain was the first one into Afghanistan, the Khyber Pass, and they used all of the opium they could drive there. And since then, they made war on the world. But China was the first conquest through the use of opium by the British and the Americans, especially, that all belonged to the top Ivy League universities and secret societies.
Well, I've even heard that that was one way that they found a way to do some kind of a balance of trade just because of those cash crops, and where we would take in our manufactured items, and then the only way for them to pay us would be through these drugs.
I'm sure it is. I mean, I can remember 10, maybe 12 years ago in Canada, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police said that investigations that they had done on the major banks in Canada said that they'd all collapse if it wasn't for the illicit drug money being laundered through them.
I heard that for ours, too.
Yeah, and that was in the mainstream media again. And, of course, nothing happened. There was no comments by parliamentarians or anything on it.
But they did crack down on anybody that ever tried to put any cash in the bank, and that they would notify. In other words, the guys at the top wanted to know who was possibly dealing, so that, you know, they got their cut. Maybe, I don't know.
Oh, it's all cuts. That's what the president of Mexico was saying. He says there's an awful lot of corruption, he says, in Mexico, but he says there's obviously high ups in the U.S. authoritarian system, he says, all involved in this too. So there's no doubt about it. It's a payoff scheme all the way down. And once again, we've got to understand that law is not equal. It never was. They used to say there was a law for the rich and a law for the poor. Well, they should still be saying that, because it's never changed. And when you see the lord system in Britain, it's interesting. When you get promoted up to a lord from a sir, etc., you now belong to a special peer group. Now, you cannot be tried by a common jury of commoners. You can only be tried by your peer group, and no peer group would ever, ever try a British lord. So it's pretty much the same in the U.S. system. These old families, the ones, the Ivy Leagues and so on, that have been involved in the Skull and Bones, all those characters that go to the Bohemian Grove, are pretty well untouchable. They'll never be brought on trial for anything, because no authority is going to go after them, especially when all the top of the police systems, etc., are all on board in the same little happy family. Yeah.
I guess we kind of have our own little caste system already built in there. Then we just,
yes, yeah. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but I do know too that quite a few years ago in Montreal, there was one of the, this was going on. For instance, they built up a police army, an internal police army across the Western world under the guise of a war on drugs. That was the main reason for it. Now, most of the police they've hired are persecuting motorists on the highway with tickets. That's what they end up doing. So it was nothing to do with persecuting the drug boys. But during the propaganda era, they were showing us the drug busts. And it was great propaganda. But what they were doing was shipping loads of stuff around to different places, and different police forces would say, look what we found. And they show you all these packages of white stuff and all the rest of it. That's the last you'd hear about them. They were actually moving them around from place to place. And Montreal, on television, they showed you this wall of massive safes, steel doors, stacked stacked full from the bottom to the top, every one of them with these packages of heroin. And about 2 weeks later, the newspaper said it all disappeared. They think it had been stolen. It was such a farce.
It's like our trillions.
But, yeah, because you see, all media is show business, and we don't think that, that the top of police and so on is involved in the show business. Of course they are. The top guys are definitely involved. The lesser boys, maybe not so much. But the top ones definitely are all involved in this. Because, as I say, the war on drugs had nothing to do with our true war on drugs. The war was simply an excuse to build up the internal armies of police for the coming war on terrorism that would be 20 years down the road. We're living in that now.
Well, I don't know if it was you or someone else that used the term war on terror is
I mean, you can take it different ways. I often call it too the war of terror, because if you look at revolutionary wars, especially the French Revolution, you had a reign of terror as soon as it started, and they had seized major control of the Bastille and so on. Then the guillotine eventually went into operation and was busy chopping away for a long, long time, until it started to devour even people who'd helped fight the revolution. That's standard in this socialist system. Everyone gets used. But you'll find they also use a technique of depopulation in France as well, because the socialists, the top socialists, who are also high Freemasons and very wealthy guys too, belonging to an elite society, who didn't have their heads chopped up, had drawn up plans for restructuring France, and they said there would be too many people in France in the 1700s. So they were depopulating areas of the peasantry in all the different provinces. This was followed up by the exact same technique when the Soviet Revolution took over, and Lenin, and it's in all the history books today, Lenin gave orders, and you'll find documentation and copies and photographs of his orders, signed, sealed, and delivered, where he told all the top people to go all over the Soviet Union with their armies and just grab hundreds of peasants here in this town, hundreds there, just anybody would do, just hang them in the trees and leave them to rot, to terrify the public. So you always have a reign of terror when they take over. That literally puts us into a Pavlovian state of shock. We don't know what to do, so we obey. Any ridiculous command, we obey. What you're seeing today under the guise of the war on terror is a war of terror. They're terrorizing the entire planet. We're allowing ourselves, as we're in this shock state, to be fingerprinted, photographed, iris scanned, voice printed, have all our data collected, have no privacy whatsoever, to hold up your pants at airports like a slave, humiliated with no shoes on. That's what that's intended to do, by the way.
Right.
This is all psychology and psychological indoctrination we're getting, to have no privacy, no rights whatsoever, and to go along with every new step that they give us until we're totally controlled from morning till night, every day of our lives. That's what it's about. This is a war of terror on the public, exactly as they've always used in the Soviet Union. Everyone in the Soviet Union was terrified that the government would eventually pull up their number and pull them in for questioning. Didn't matter who you were.
Well, one of the ones that's spooky to me is these youth corps that they're going to be starting here, because that was how they, you know, they found ways to turn families against their own, you know, afraid to speak in front of each other.
Yes. Well, the Hitler youth did the same thing in Germany. They always use the youth. Whenever you see youth camps sprouting up, you're under... that they're getting ideological indoctrination. That's what it's for. And strange enough, Obama immediately started to give a big grants already to education, as he called it, which is another way of saying ideological indoctrination for the youth. You're seeing the same. Why change a system that's proven to work? These guys will always use the same formula when it's been proven to work in the past.
Where do you think that came from? I mean, what the model that Lenin was following, where do you think his came from?
Lenin and the socialist movement. See, the socialist movement people don't realize how massive the revolutionary movements, as they called them in the 1800s, which really socialist movements were. Every country had them. London was the main base for them. In fact, the British Empire welcomed them. They sheltered Karl Marx and gave him protection to write his Communist Manifesto. He was simply a hack journalist that was given the job to do it. That was all.
Didn't they even school him and others like Hitler and Stalin and those? Didn't some of them go to school of a sort in London?
I don't think so. Okay. Stalin himself went to a Jesuit school. The better schools in Europe were Jesuit, had Jesuit teachers.
Had their own version of it, did they not?
Jesuits also were heavily involved in education in different schools as well. The mm-hmm. best ones were Jesuit, had Jesuit teachers, even in the U.S. for a long time as well. To become a Jesuit, I think, takes 18 years
really?
Of training. And even then, you're highly selected. You'd be very intelligent and be very, very good before you'd even passed. So they're exceptional teachers.
So they start with them really young, then?
Yeah, and you wouldn't have to be Catholic to go to their schools. Or in Europe, that's how it was in the old days. It didn't matter if you were Jewish, Protestant, Catholic, or whatever. The better ones, if you wanted a good education, that you'd send your children off to the Jesuit schools. And Lenin went to a Jesuit school. He was trained there. Marx was from Germany, and he was kicked out of Germany and given protection by the elite of London, and backed again by the bankers, because the bankers, as I say, were behind the whole idea of socialism. Socialism would demand a central government, you see,
mm-hmm.
and a central bank. And that's exactly what the bankers wanted, because bankers, if they're lending to individuals, have to send their own henchmen out to try and get the money back if the people can't pay them. If you get a government that's federalized, centralized, then the government will have agencies and police and so on that will come and collect the tax for them that they then pay to the bankers. So it's much easier for these banking fraternities to get their money. That's why they advocate centralization. So they backed socialism, if not invented it, in fact, and a controlled society, because once again, bankers depend on long-term interest coming in, massive interest, intergenerational loans. It might take five generations to pay off a particular debt. Britain only paid off its debt for World War One in 1990. It's still paying off World War Two and Korea. So they're intergenerational. We don't realize that bankers, that I'm talking about international bankers, 13 families really,
mm-hmm.
Lend to the entire planet. And they all pick their leaders, because they do have a leader every 10 years or so. They pick the leader from amongst themselves. They're the ones who advocate world socialism because it suits their purpose. They deal with intergenerational payments. They're ensured that governments will make sure that all loans are paid from the taxpayer, and the governments themselves will use some of that tax money to create agencies and polices and so on that will collect the taxes to pay the loans off. In fact, when Lincoln, just right at the end of the Civil War, American Civil War, and it's in the Congressional Records, the letter of the telegraph that he got from Karl Marx is there. Karl Marx congratulated Lincoln. He says, because it's a must, he says, I congratulate you for making the centralizing government and making it stronger. That's an essential plank in the manifesto.
And do you think that was a concerted effort on his part?
I think we're given a very vague, distorted, and whitewashed version of pretty well all history,
mm-hmm.
to be honest with you.
Yeah, I'm not, I don't doubt.
Yeah. And again, too, it's like Benjamin Disraeli said, he was a prime minister of Britain in the 1800s, he says the public don't know, he says they have no imagination of the real power that's behind the scenes that controls the destiny of nations, you know.
Well, Do you see anything positive that we can do or coming out of this? Are you, I mean, because you're so dedicated at educating the public on what is going on.
Yeah.
You have to have some kind of hope of sorts to even be doing that, I would figure.
You have to have a hope, but you also must have some connection to life itself. I think today the problem has been caused, and the problem is really the result of attack on the general public. People feel so isolated, so into themselves, egocentric, is what Bertrand Russell says. If we can create an egocentric society, they won't care what's happening to other people. The individual will be too happy in their little bubble. But you see, again, ironically, the enemy of this socialist system is true individuality. And the United Nations has stated that too, that the enemy of the United Nations and world socialism is individuality. Under socialism, you're going to be part, you're a cog in the machine. You get no special privilege. You're a servant to the world state. Your purpose is to serve the world state. So until people recapture their individuality, it's game over. And we've got to get out of this little bubble of contentment at the television, sucking at the teat at the television, and filling our faces with junk food or whatever else we're doing, and start realizing what happens to people across the world or across your state even, or even next door to you, reflects on you. You can't let bad things happen to other people by your government. You can't allow your government to do nasty things, because eventually they're going to come round to you.
Right.
So you have to have a principle to stand for in the first place. Most people don't have any principles left, except that they'll only fight for the things they're told to fight for: sustainable development, depopulation, greening, etc. It's whatever they're programmed to demand, they demand. And they don't realize they've got to stand up as individuals, but they've got to stop right away. And you cannot compromise with totalitarianism. You have to start demanding that they abolish the data banks on every individual that's taking over your privacy. You've got to start demanding that they abolish the state's supposed rights to govern your children. That's not what governments are there for. When governments are bent on social policy and behavior modification of the populace, that is a different function altogether, and it's not elected government. That's totalitarianism.
Well, another aspect that they seem to be bent on is trying to destroy the belief systems of people.
Yeah.
And
well, that was essential, because, and again, the revolutionary movements funded by the banks had all that figured out too in the 1800s and before, because you cannot, as I say, when you take a culture and you stand back and look at a people and its culture, the one common thing they have is a common value system that comes as part of your culture. So you have a value system of human life, each other's lives, and you also have simple rules of the tribe, or taboos as they used to call them before religions. Everyone knew the taboos. You didn't need police officers, etc., etc., to do things that the people knew what to do. And government, of course, must supplant all natural functions in society, but to supplant them, they must destroy that which held and bound society together, common principles.
Well, if they destroy all of our ability to, I mean, if they make everything we do illegal, and they destroy all the ability to understand the difference between moral and immoral, because they've made it, it's just kind of like our laws, they've made them absurd.
Yeah.
And so once going back to something simpler and having some basic morals, that is one of the basics we're going to have to even do what you're talking
about. Yes, absolutely. Government is not in the business of guiding culture. That's not the purpose of government. Never was. When it is in the business of guiding and altering and directing cultural changes and political correctness and new normals, then it's not an elected government. It's an agenda. Now, Thomas Jefferson said this very thing. And you find it in his memoirs, in his letters. He says, when you see an agenda, the same things being pushed through between houses, it meant between changes in political parties in Congress. It says, know then that you're under tyranny. Because technically, when a new house comes in, it can throw out all the laws of the previous house if it wants to. That never happens.
Boy, that would be nice.
Yeah. But he said that when you see the same... Now, since you've been born, I'm sure, right up to the present time, everything the UN has mandated and everything that's been signed has been implemented in your country and across the world by all the other signatories to the treaties. Therefore, you're under an agenda, an ongoing, pre-planned, step-by-step agenda to world government and a totally controlled society. We're under tyranny already, even though they keep up the pretense of democracy and voting and all this nonsense.
Right.
We are under an agenda, and it's never faltered, because it's using scientific principles of indoctrination through the school, through all media, through entertainment, to control us every step of the way and guide us. As I say, they never mention any of this when they elect us. It's always the welfare system, education system, health, etc. That's all they talk about. They never go into the fact that they're given massive power to what are supposedly services, like a health service. The health service is now an authority that mandates that we get inoculations.
Right.
Police services were exactly that. They were police services, and the public could kick them out if they didn't do their job or they didn't do what the public wanted. Now they're called police enforcers and authorities. We've been taken over by changes in terminology gradually in its psycholinguistics. And all it takes is one generation to miss what's happening, and then the next generation is born into will think it's all quite normal. Children who were born in 2001 will shortly be teenagers in a few years, ready for the military. They've been born into a world where martial law is the normal, and the guys in the black suits and machine guns are the good guys as they kick the peasants around. We don't realize we have massive indoctrination is going on all the time. You can't even watch a comedy without being programmed in political correctness.
Right.
This is coordination. Exactly what Bertrand Russell said would happen. The entertainment industry is your main method. In fact, you can get more cultural changes put through entertainment than non-fiction. Because we don't realize that we're actually being indoctrinated through the entertainment.
Right. Well, you know, Alan, I really appreciate you staying up extra late and again, educating our audience on a lot of the research and things that you have done. And would you like to go ahead and give us your websites again and say anything else in closing?
Yes, they can look into my website at cuttingthroughthematrix.com. And I've got books and discs there for sale, but there's hundreds and hundreds of hours of talks for free they can download and listen to, where I go over much of this in more detail. And they can also go into Alan Watts Sentinel.eu, where they can get transcripts of these talks and print them up. And they're written in the different languages of Europe.
Yeah. Well, again, Alan, I want to thank you, and I hope we'll have you up again sometime.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.